I finished high school in Northern California, and then I went to college at the American College in Paris for 2 years. And then transferred to UCLA. I moved to Los Angeles, went there for undergrad and graduate work, and then moved to San Francisco in 1993.
So in addition to being a composer, you're also a pianist?
Yes. I started off being that was my goal, was to be a concert pianist, although I loved musical theater.
Obviously.
I was a classical pianist who grew up loving, movie musicals and wanted to do that. Didn't know anything about opera. Thought it was really dumb. I still do.
Well, legend has it that you were working for the PR department of the San Francisco Opera. And it's kind of interesting how this all evolves. So tell us how you go from the PR department to being an opera composer.
Yes, it's not your usual career trajectory, is it? I was living in Los Angeles, and that's where I did my undergraduate and graduate work. And I was a double major as a composer and pianist as an undergrad, and then I entered as a piano major for my master's, and I switched to composition. I left that program when I injured my right hand. It was a slow-growing injury called a focal dystonia. Which was a problem where my fingers would curl up in my right hand. It's not uncommon injury for musicians as well as people who do sign language, play the guitar, you know, anyone who uses and stresses their hand. Luckily, mine was not neurological, and I was able to re-educate my hand. But during the period when I was doing that, I had to find a way to sustain myself. And it was about a 5-year really dark period because I couldn't play the piano anymore. And that's how I had primarily identified myself as a musician from about the age of 7 or 8. So it was very distressing at 28 years old not to be able to do that anymore. And I didn't compose for 5 years either. What I found that I could do is I could write about music really well from the inside. As a performer, as someone who had been a collaborative musician and had degrees in music. And so I worked for the UCLA Center for the Arts. And then when I moved to Northern California, I worked at Cal Performances at UC Berkeley in their PR marketing department as the writer for the entire company. And then a job opened at San Francisco Opera. And I was invited to join the staff there and be the writer for the company. And my job was to get to know the singers, the conductors, the orchestra, the chorus, every department, the administration, props, costumes, scenery, and write about them and communicate all of this information to the press and get stories and play stories. And, you know, you couldn't have imagined a better apprenticeship for someone who is an aspiring opera composer, except I didn't know I was an aspiring opera composer. When I got there, my hand had come back, so I was playing the piano again. And I met and talked with some of the greatest singers on the planet, who also happened to be some of the greatest people on the planet, including Friederike von Stade, Renee Fleming, Thomas Hampson, Sylvia McNair, Jennifer Larmour, Bryn Terfel, and in taking them around to interviews, we would, you know, share life stories and things, and they would ask what I did besides being the PR guy at the opera. And I said, well, in another life, I was a composer. And invariably, they said, well, I'd love to see something that you wrote sometime. And I always thought they were being nice. And out of the blue, it was Friederike von Stade who really sort of said she'd really love to see something. And so as a surprise, because she inspired me so much, I wrote three folk song settings, and I gave them to her as an opening night gift of The Dangerous Liaisons. She was doing the world premiere of Conrad Souza and Philip Littell's opera, The Dangerous Liaisons. And I gave them to her that night, and she was really delighted, and she came in early the next performance so that we could read through them. And I thought, well, this is as good as this is ever going to get. Here's a dream come true. I'm playing for Friederike von Stade, things that I wrote. And she leaned over and she said, you know, Jake, these are really good. Would you like to give a concert together sometime? And I said, sure, I think I can make space in my calendar to play a concert with you. And so, true to her word, she invited me to play for her, and we actually traveled together. I started writing a lot for her, and she told everyone she knew about this composer that she knew in San Francisco. And suddenly I was getting requests from really amazing singers from all over the world who were traveling with my music. I won a competition through G. Schirmer, their art song competition. And then one day, out of the blue, the general director at that time, Lotfi Mansouri, pulled me aside. I thought he wanted me to write another press release or speech or something like that, because I had my day job, of course. And he said, well, you're getting these songs performed all over the world. I think you might be a theater composer. Singers love your work. Audiences respond to it. He goes, we have a spot in the 2000-2001 season for a new opera, and I'm looking for a discovery. And so I'd like to send you to New York to meet with Terrence McNally. I've been trying to get him to write a libretto and see if you guys might come up with an opera for our main stage season in 2000. Well, my first response was, who are you talking to? But I went to New York and I met with Terrence McNally. And initially, Lotfi had wanted us to think about writing a comedy, you know, something light and bubbly and frothy and fun for the millennium. And you should have seen Lotfi's face when Terrence and I came back to him and suggested Dead Man Walking. But that was our suggestion, and that's where it started. And Lotfi created a composer in residence position for me so that I could transition out of my other job but still be employed. It was just remarkable, like Cinderella type story, where all of my dreams suddenly came true because this ingenious, innovative impresario who was always on the lookout for talent gave me an opportunity like that. And so it became the road to creating the opera Dead Man Walking.
Terrence McNally has a huge following on his own. I mean, he's so great. And how did you two decide then, or come to the decision to do this Dead Man Walking?
Well, Terrence was not interested in a comic opera, which is what Lotfi had asked us about for San Francisco. He was interested, if he was going to do an opera, he wanted to do a big American drama that had real resonance and felt very relevant and of our time, but also felt timeless and also had sort of international impact. In other words, that's what really wonderful opera stories have, is they feel timeless and resonant throughout history because the characters feel sort of mythological stature, and that the issues that are at stake are things that people will deal with over and over because they're very human issues. And he said he was walking down the street one day and just suddenly Dead Man Walking popped into his head, and he got very excited about it. And he came to San Francisco to tell me a list of ideas that he had, but he said there was only one that he really wanted to do. He had 10 ideas that he'd written down. There was only one he really wanted to do, and he hoped that it would be the same one I wanted to do, because if it wasn't, it was really the only thing he was interested in, and maybe we weren't meant to work together. So he set to reading his list, and the first thing he said was Dead Man Walking, and I responded instantly. Every hair on my head went up, and I got chills. I got that musical rush. I just felt like something important had happened, and it just was a brilliant idea because it was a great American drama, and yet it's a universal drama about something that people have to deal with in every society throughout history and into the future. And so that's when I told him, you can stop reading right there. I know that's the right subject. And he asked if he could please continue reading the list, and he did, but my mind had already been set on Dead Man Walking because, again, it felt very American but universal, very much of our time and yet timeless. The people in it, their emotional journeys and the conflicts within it were so large, it made sense that it would fill an opera house, the emotional content. I could imagine solos, ensembles, choruses. It felt like it had the trajectory. It felt like it had the resonance and the the excitement. It also, at that time, had great name recognition because the book and the movie had been out only recently, and the movie had won an Academy Award for Susan Sarandon. And it was controversial, which I also liked. And the good thing about that subject, too, was it wasn't people saying, well, what is that? It was people saying, why are you going to do that, and how are you going to do that? And that's a great place to start, because you're not explaining what the piece is. You're talking about really the elements of how are you going to translate that onto the stage so that it feels pertinent and immediate and accessible. And so that's really how it came about. It was Terrence McNally's brilliant idea. And Sister Helen Prejean jumped on board right away. She called me out of the blue. I picked up the phone and she said, I'd like to speak to Jake Heggie. And I said, this is Jake. She goes, Jake, this is Sister Helen Prejean. And I just heard that the San Francisco Opera wants to make an opera out of Dead Man Walking. You know what I said, Jake? And I said, no. I hope you said yes. She said, I said, of course we're going to make an opera out of Dead Man Walking. But Jake, I don't know boo scat about opera, so you're going to have to educate me. And she asked, she said, now you don't write this atonal stuff, right? We're going to have a tune we can hum. We're going to have some music we can hang on to. And I assured her that I was a very lyrical composer, and my goal was lyricism that the audience would embrace, that would enhance and enliven the characters and their journeys and the story. And we got along very well right from the start, and she was a great friend to the project. She never wanted to interfere. All she asked at the beginning was that it remain a story of redemption. And we said, absolutely. Well, you know, our goal is to remain true to the story that you told. She knew that things would have to change, that characters would have to disappear or be combined or be invented, but that the goal was a story of redemption and transformation. And that's what we tried to accomplish.